Welcome back, Hemingbrainiacs, to the Hemingbrainiac Society. It's a society. Just having a conversation before, earlier tonight, with a friend, and talking about how we're talking about podcasts, and how even your favourite podcasts, there's days when you go, you're a bit of a dickhead today, you know? And there's days when you wonder, like, do I like this person or do I hate them? And some podcasters you listen to for years and just slowly realize that they're kind of dickhead, or that they might grate at you or whatever. Like Joe Rogan for me is one that I listen to so much. Joe Rogan, I just recently can't stand him. I can't stand the way that everything he says is a list, and he makes these like verbal lists in the middle of every sentence, and the sentence go on and it goes on and blah blah blah. Like it's like there's like a drop down list of dot points in every sentence he makes. I'm trying to do an example of it, but I'm not even that good. Because people might listen to podcasts for different reasons, like they're on a treadmill or they're walking or they're in their office, and it's crazy, it's weird. And he makes a list like that, right? A little drop down list, and then he always ends up with it's crazy. But then he'll say like, it's crazy, it's so weird, it's so strange. And it's like, even that's a little drop down list of like synonyms or alternate sort of takes. And to point that out to a friend, I like just recorded 1 minute of him talking and it was just a random minute. It wasn't like a specific one that I chopped. I was literally just like pointed my phone at the podcast that was running and recorded it. And he, in that 1 minute of talking, he made like 13 verbal lists or something. Like once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. And if he does it, you know, a dozen times in a minute over 2 hours, he's done it maths is several hundred times, you know, and over several years of doing it, I've just heard him make like 10,000 shitty little verbal lists. I can't unhear it. And now, if you are a Joe Rogan listener, you'll notice it, and you probably won't be able to stand him either. anyway, what was my point? I've just got sidetracked. Oh yeah. So sometimes the podcasters you listen to, you gradually just realize, like, I think that's why celebrities don't give much of themselves away. They stay a bit mysterious. It's because otherwise, they just slowly start to seem like that kind of dumbass friend that you've got who runs their mouth too much. And you know what I mean? Like they become too, they get too familiar, and the spell of kind of host audience is worn off, and you just start to not really respect the artist much. So I was thinking about me in that context of you hearing my voice every day. And, I suppose one particular thing that has been bothering me since maybe about a week ago was that disagreement, I suppose, with Jan Brunt about like literary misogynism. And I was like kind of vaguely aware that I was being a dickhead, and it was a weird hill to die on for me. And I don't know, I just felt like I was a bit unfair in, because I know that it's a real issue for women, and I wasn't trying to deny you the cross that you bear that I gave to you. You ought to know. You know what I mean? But I was sort of denying you your own cross that you bear. Good old Alanis Morissette. By the way, Alanis Morissette says, it's not fair to deny me of the cross I bear that you gave to me. Not cross-eyed bear. Which most people think she says cross-eyed bear, like a little toy. No, the cross I bear. It's such a good lyric when you actually know what it is. I bet of the couple of hundred people who hear this podcast, I just blew like 20% of your minds by telling you that lyric, because so many people have that lyric wrong in their heads. Anyway, I like what Bill Burr says. He says, we're all out here eating a shit sandwich, you know, and it's not worth complaining that your shit sandwich is worse than another person's, right? Or like denying them how shitty their situation is because of your shitty situation. And I think that's what I was doing. And even Jan Brunt said, like, my bias is not allowing me to see it from her point of view. And I think, yeah, maybe, like, my bias was that my shit sandwich is that there's a frustration linked to literary misogynism being unjustly put onto me. And that's my shit sandwich. And with that frustration, I'm approaching the topic, but I'm also denying the very real shit sandwich, and probably a worse shit sandwich, that Jan Brunt is eating in being a female and being frustrated that the women are always downtrodden and sort of mistreated by the author. So, yeah, I don't know. I just thought I might have been a dickhead. I might have been a dickhead. So I do apologize to all, everyone, especially Jan, but to everyone, because you all had to listen through that, me being a dickhead. So there's me eating humble pie. And I think I'm happy to eat humble pie because I do think I was unfair. And I also really appreciate this community for being, well, for letting me be part of it, I suppose. Like, it's a weird thing to say, seeing as I kind of created the community. But I didn't, really. I just made a subreddit. That's my phone beeping, by the way. but it's a nice place to be part of, and I do appreciate being part of it, and I shouldn't take that for granted and be a dickhead. So I do apologize for my dickheadedness. Anyway, we're not here to talk about me being a dickhead. We're here to talk about Julian probably being a dickhead. Book 2, Chapter 4. Now, I got to say, I got to read the schmoop.com on this one, because that whole chapter washed over me. I was not in a place to read a fairly dense chapter last night. And so, it in one ear and out the other for me. So, Schmoop. The Schmoop summary. Hang on 1 minute. My phone is just... Why is it always a... It's always when you start recording that you start getting notifications. Or maybe I just don't notice how many notifications I get until I start recording. Maybe I should put it on silent. Nah. All right, Schmoop summary. It becomes clear to Julian that the dealer moles and their friends suffer from deep boredom. One of the reasons might be that they never tolerate any serious subjects in their conversation. Everything has to be about superficial amusement. It's no wonder they're bored. The only reason that people come to the dealer mole's house is because they want something from the marquise. Everyone seems to know this, and it makes everything in the house seem hollow. First of all, what is a marquise? A nobleman ranking above a count and below a duke. There we go. One day Julian asks Father Perard whether he'd be allowed to stop eating dinner with the de la Moles, since it's so boring. Then he realizes that the Marquis's daughter was listening. He feels like he's really put his foot in it, but he doesn't realize that Matilda feels the same way. It turns out that Matilda has a little social group that makes fun of how boring her parents' friends are. Julian soon finds his way into this company. He's shocked, though, because he doesn't think it's appropriate to sit around insulting people behind their backs. Julian hears his rival Tambo talking about how a poet named Beranger should be thrown into a dungeon for 10 years because he writes obscene political things, and Julian thinks Tambo is a monster. Father Perard beckons Julian over and tells him not to write anything political in the French language or the Marquise will dislike him forever. Julian goes upstairs and burns a few things he's been writing. I enjoyed this chapter. Stendhal is skewering everybody in this aristocratic salon using Julian as his observer. I'm sure that all the name-dropping of people I've never heard would have been quite familiar to Stendhal's contemporary readers. Yeah, I was actually thinking during this chapter, that a character map might be handy at this point of the novel, because there's so many names being thrown around now, and there's literally like four or five names in the book who I know who they are. Julian, Madame de Renal, Monsieur de Renal, and Father Pirard to an extent. And every other name to me, I'm not really sure who they are. And that must be at least a dozen people who are like fairly main characters. So not good. That's not good. I need, I think, a character map, a character cheat sheet. Starfall said, sometimes one word describing a character makes me change my view or impression of that character. I feel the word parvenu, used by the narrator in the library scene describing Ape Pirard, was harsh, or at least it did not fit with the picture I had of him. For me, he is someone who takes advantage of an opportunity to better himself, but he is a social climber. Parvenu. A person of obscure origin who has gained wealth, influence, or celebrity. So someone who came from nowhere, rose to the cream of the crop. I found it funny that immediately Julian felt the need to go burn his manuscript. I couldn't wait till the end of the evening. This whole chapter felt like a scene from a Molière play. Altreet said, I think people around Julian could easily see him as a social climber. Remember when he put on that blue suit Madame de Renal got him for the parade and everyone was snarking on him. Personally, I think he's too ambitious to be mere social climber. He's like a social vaulter. Well, is he a social climber? Like he has risen through the ranks of social society, I should say. For sure, but, and he is ambitious, but he doesn't seem to be too preoccupied with like status, does he? Oh, maybe he is slightly, but it's different from that though, right? It's like more like he's preoccupied with success and making a name for himself. He wants to be like renowned, but not just to have the status, you know, like a title. He wants to actually achieve things. I think it seems that way at least. Laura Y. Stitch said, I like the details in this chapter. Great insight into the characters. Just it was too long. Yeah, it was quite long. But, you know, this chapter that we're reading tonight is really short. So it's gone from quite a long one to this one is 1 to 2.5 pages, this chapter. So we'll change of pace. This book has the most variation in chapter lengths, I think, of any book we've read so far. Chapter 5 is called Sensitivity and a Pious Lady. Any vital idea has an air of vulgarity there, so completely are they used to monotonous talk. Woe to him who has an inventive way of speaking. Forblas. When, after several months of trial, the house steward handed him his salary for the third quarter, this is the stage Julian had reached. Monsieur de la Mole had ordered him to attend to the administration of his lands in Brittany and in Normandy. Julian made frequent journeys there. He was put in charge of the correspondence relating to the famous lawsuit with the Abbe de Frilliers. He had been briefed on this by Monsieur Pirard. On the basis of the brief jottings the Marquis scribbled in the margins of all kinds of paperwork that came in, Julian composed letters that were nearly always passed as fit for signature. At the theological school, his teachers complained of his limited application, but nonetheless regarded him as one of their most distinguished pupils. These varying tasks, undertaken with all the eagerness of unassuaged ambition, had very quickly robbed Julian of the fresh complexion he had brought from the provinces. In the eyes of his young comrades in the seminary, his pallor was a merit. He found them less spiteful, much less subservient to mere cash than those at Besançon. They believed him afflicted by consumption. The Marquise had supplied him with a horse. Nervous of being encountered while out riding, Julian had told them that this exercise had been prescribed him by the doctors. Abbe Pirard had introduced him to several Jansenist societies. Julian was amazed. The idea idea of religion was inextricably linked in his mind with those of hypocrisy and the desire for financial gain. He was impressed by these stern and pious men who had no thought of money. Several of the Jansenists had taken a liking to him and gave him advice. A new prospect opened up before him. Among the Jansenists, he got to know a certain Comte Altamira, who was almost 6 foot tall, a liberal who had been sentenced to death in his own country, and very pious. This strange contrast between religious devotion and the love of liberty astounded him. Julian's relations with the young Comte had chilled. Norbert thought he had reacted too sharply to some of his friend's pleasantries. Having once or twice failed to behave appropriately, Julian had resolved never to say another word to Mademoiselle de la Mole. In the Hotel de la Mole, they were always perfectly polite to him, but he felt himself to have declined in favour. His provincial common sense explained this phenomenon by the popular saying, "What's beautiful is what's new." Perhaps he was a little more perceptive than he had been in the first few days, or rather perhaps the first enchantment with Parisian urbanity had faded. From the moment he finished his work each day, he became prey to a deadly boredom. Such was the desiccating effect of that courtesy which characterizes high society, admirable in itself, but so regulated, so closely graduated according to one's standing. Any even slightly sensitive heart can perceive this artifice. Undoubtedly, the provinces can be accused of commonness of tone and lack of polish, but at least people there show some warmth in their responses. At the Hotel de la Mole, Julian's pride was never attacked, but frequently, at the close of day, he would feel an urge to burst into tears. A waiter in the provinces takes an interest in you. Should you suffer a mishap while entering his café, and if that mishap has in it something embarrassing to your pride, he will, while commiserating with you, come back to the word that torments you over and over again. In Paris they take the trouble to conceal their laughter, but you are always treated as a stranger. We may pass in silence over a crowd of little adventures that would have made Julian ridiculous if, in a sense, he had not been beneath ridicule. An absurd oversensitivity led him into thousands of awkward mistakes. All his recreations were defensive. He practiced with a pistol every day, and he was one of the leading pupils at the most celebrated masters at arms. Whenever he had a moment to spare, instead of using it for reading, as he would have in the past, he ran to the livery stables and demanded the most vicious horses. In his outings with the riding master, it was almost a matter of course for him to be thrown to the ground. The Marquise was well satisfied with his persistent working habits, his discretion and his intelligence, and gradually confided to him, the conduct of all business that was slightly difficult to disentangle. At the odd times when his lofty ambitions allowed him some scope for it, the Marquise conducted his business affairs shrewdly. Being in a position to keep up with new developments, he was able to gamble with success. He bought houses and woodlands, but he easily became riled. He gave away hundreds of louis, then sued for hundreds of francs. Rich men of high spirit look to business transactions for amusement, not for results. The Marquise needed a chief of staff who could instill a clear and comprehensible order into all his financial affairs. Although he so gravely constrained a temperament, Madame de la Mole sometimes mocked Julian. Great ladies are horrified by the unpredictability that sensibility can produce. It is at the opposite pole to decorum. On two or three occasions, the Marquise came to his defence. If he is ridiculous in your salon, he triumphs when he is at his desk. For his part, Julian believed that he had discovered the Marquise's secret. She condescended to take an interest in everything from the moment that the Baron de la Jumart was announced. He was a frigid creature of inscrutable physiognomy. He was short, dainty, ugly, very well dressed, spent his life at the chateau, and normally had nothing to say about anything. That reflected the cast of his mind. Madame de la Mole would have been rapturously happy for the first time in her life if she could have gained him as a husband for her daughter. All righty then. There we go, another chapter chaptered. We did it. Nice little chapter, tidy, concise. I'm happy. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.